some of the best concerts you felt you've had here at the theater. I know Bill Maher came through and had an HBO special. Talk to us about that.
Well, that was exciting. He, you know, being a very blue, you know, liberal comedian, he was always impressed that he could raise such a big crowd here in Oklahoma when he came. He didn't understand that. So when he got ready to do his HBO special, he said, well, let's take it to Oklahoma, just for the kind of contrast that that would provide. So he's always been a fan of coming here to do his show. I've only met him briefly. He's an interesting guy. I don't think he's as partisan as people like to think he is. I think he's more fair-minded than a lot of people think, but he's always had a good turnout here. And it was exciting to have the HBO television crews come in and do that and get to see all of their fancy technology.
Stand-up comedians have done well here, haven't they?
It's turning out to where stand-up is going to be a very big part of our, you know, of our attractions.
George Carlin performed here.
At least three times. And I would pick him up at the airport. I would be his chauffeur that day.
What was that like?
Oh,
was
he's awesome.
So but, George, was George riding around in his car about the same kind of guy that he would be
yes,
on stage?
Yes. Usually comedians, it's interesting, they you know, musicians have to rehearse their material. Well, comedians are very similar. When you pick them up in the afternoon, a lot of times they're just going over the jokes that they have to memorize that night. They don't want to make mistakes. So they're a little bit distracted. Kind of like, I'm glad to have this conversation with you, but I need to get to my dressing room. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I need to cram over my jokes that I'm going to be telling. Because what an art it is to stand up there for an hour or an hour and 15 minutes and tell memorized jokes and get the audience, you know, engaged with it. That is a real craft.
Yes, and to make it look as easy as they
right.
do.
Right.
When you know they've really worked hard to memorize, as you've just said. And then some of them just take off on their own.
Right.
They didn't know they were going to say it.
They, right. The really talented ones can ad-lib on it.
Don Henley with Sheryl Crow was...
That was a memorable one. That was the first time he came in. And we didn't know it at the time because Sheryl Crow was not famous at the time, but she was playing bass for him. And a great show. And at the end, they did Hotel California as a duet, and they danced together. And it's one of the ones I will always remember. Robin Williams, he was here two or three times.
Did you get to be around him?
The first time, he didn't have his manager with him. He just showed up at about 11 in the morning. And you could tell he was kind of a, you know, he wanted some interaction with people. So he didn't just stay in his dressing room. He walked around and talked to everybody all afternoon. And he was totally the same Robin Williams off camera as he was on. Cracking jokes all the time. Just hilarious.
Beach Boys' Brian Wilson?
One of my favorites.
Why?
Well, I was always a fan of Beach Boys' music, number one. And there was so much heart and soul put into that concert. I know it's played here in Tulsa twice. You know, one time was at a casino. But he had the children of some of the Beach Boys musicians playing instruments, Mike Love's son and some others. And they played the old Beach Boys songs with so much heart and soul that it was sold out. The audience loved it. Everybody just loved Brian Wilson.
Yeah,
he wasn't at 100%, you know, for whatever reasons. He can't perform at 100%, but it didn't matter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What it?
Yeah.
Was it last year that Bob Dylan was here?
I believe so, about a year ago.
My wife and I attended that concert. Let me just jump in and say we were so enamored by the fact that he took his upright piano, faced the back of it, to the front of the auditorium and basically stayed behind that and apparently did not want us to see what he looked like at 80-some years old.
Yeah, the lights were rather dim, weren't they, yeah, back there by his piano.
Right.
You know, another interesting story about that performance is that they had just opened his archives down the street, and he didn't stop by.
No.
And there was a Tulsa Drillers baseball game that night, and he walked down to the base. Bought a ticket, went in for a few minutes, and then walked back to the theater. He probably did walk by his archive place when he took that walk. Yeah, you know he did. So in a sense, he did check it out.
Well, we'd heard about the Driller, so you've confirmed it now. So yeah. that's interesting.
And he's probably been at Brady. He's not the type of artist that's, you know, we have a lot of competition with casinos. Tulsa Theater does, and it's no secret. So, there are certain artists that will not play at casinos, and he is one of them. He's not going to play at a casino. So when he does come to Tulsa, he plays at Tulsa Theater. I think he's played at Kane's one time. But... And it's largely the same show. He considers himself an ultimate artist, which of course he is. And as such, he will change his show around a little bit. He will change arrangements of the music slightly. He doesn't want to be categorized just as this 60s artist who was huge in the 60s and just wants to be remembered as that. He wants to be remembered as an artist in true form that is able to change and adapt his music as he goes forward. So he will change the arrangement. Sometimes he'll be playing a song that is a familiar song, but you don't know for sure if he's playing Blowing in the Wind because he's changed the arrangement so much. But that's, I think his audience understands that. It's not that he's out to please typical, you know, fans that want that. I think the fans understand that he's going to be artistic when he goes out.
You'd consider yourself a fan of Bob Dylan.
Sure. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Right.
He changed. He, in my mind, from that generation of disruptive music that happened in the 60s, you know, just a handful of groups go into that pool, and he's definitely one of them. Along with the Beatles and the Stones and a few others.
I grew up in North Dakota, and I was always taken with him because he grew up in Hibbing, Minnesota.
Right.
And then he actually made his way to Minneapolis and got his legs under him, and then things took off for him.
And went to the coffee houses in Greenwich Village.
So then he made that connection with Woody Guthrie.
Yes, he did.
When he was in New York and was really taken with him, and as I understand, would visit him in his later years when he was,
right,
Woody was real sick. And so because of that, we have Dylan Museum here.
I think that's a connection that he made.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which is wonderful.
Right.
That we have two of those outstanding artists.
Makes it another place of destination, doesn't it?
It does.
But you're also taken with the Beatles and can name every song they ever recorded.
Well, our band's, out of the 211 songs, the band has probably played 150 of them.
Yeah.
I would recognize every song they recorded. I don't know if I could recite the name of everyone. But,
right.
Yeah.
What drew you to the Beatles?
Well, my whole generation was drawn to it. Again, you know, the piano was in the living room. Just about half of the teenagers of the day would talk their parents into buying a guitar or some drums or something. Everyone wanted to be like them.
Mm-hmm.
Garage bands flourished. You know, which brings up an interesting comparison because today, if you're interested in music, you can go to Guitar Center and buy a recording setup. And you can get your music out on YouTube. You know, you and your buddies, your musician buddies, can get your music out. Back in the day, you had to be chosen by a record company in order to even have a chance of doing that. And the chances of that happening were so small. But still, everyone wanted to do it. So when the Beatles music came out, it was so different from, say, Elvis and Frank Sinatra before that, that it was such a departure from the previous form of rock music that everyone wanted to be a part of it. And it was mainly a British invasion of music. The Americans did great. You know, Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young. I mean, the list goes on and on of fantastic. Billy Joel. Lots of great American composers in the rock genre. But at the time, it was the Beatles. It was the Stones. It was the Who. All the British groups, which were getting all the attention. And the young teenagers at the time wanted to be a part of it somehow. So my brother was a musician. He had a band at the time, and they would play a selection of music, and Beatles would obviously be included in that. Now, if you want to analyze the talent capabilities of the Beatles, you know, a multitude of books have been written about it, and even though they did find the record company and they found the right producer, which definitely helped them in their careers, they had incredible talent. The lyrics were outstanding. And even though they were not formally trained, they understand how to put chords together in a way that were so above their heads, really. You just had to shake your heads of how did they come up with that? Mm-hmm. You know, not being formally trained musicians. Right. When Paul met John Lennon in Liverpool, John was playing a guitar that was tuned like a banjo because he didn't know how to make chords on a sixth string. It's easier to make chords on a banjo. So he had tuned his six-string guitar, I think it only had four strings on it, like a banjo. And from there, became one of the greatest songwriters in musical history. So it was that kind of admiration for their talent that it wasn't just me. It was that whole generation of the 60s.
Yeah.